I'm Mary Carlson from St. Olaf College. A number of you here I've already met. This is the last in my series this week on family issues, faith challenges, and it's about HIV/AIDS in the family. When I was up here the first time on teaching staff, I had come as a medical social worker, and I worked for years in the first private HIV clinic in Minnesota in the mid to late 80s. So I did 10 sessions on AIDS back in the late 80s because it was still such an unknown, and people were still very distressed and concerned and worried and fearful of infection and all kinds of things. It's interesting to me that I felt I could do one session on AIDS and do it justice. I can't, obviously. So I'm just taking one piece of what I think is a very important family issue for many folks in our country and many more in the world, and I'd be happy to have some conversation when we're done. In addition to doing the HIV social work practice, I've taught a course at St. Olaf most of the last 10 years called HIV/AIDS in Our Lives, and have been pleased that it fills up every time I teach it, primarily with pre-med students, nursing students, social work and education folks, and then people who worry about their own risk. So it's an interesting professional, personal mix of student motivation to take the class. We also in Northfield have a community AIDS task force that has some training as a care team for people in our rural area who are diagnosed with HIV, so that we can provide assistance to them in the less accessible places that rural Minnesota is. People here, how many of you know somebody personally who has HIV disease? Okay, yeah. I would assume that's who would come, probably. And are any of you doing current caregiving for somebody sort of on a regular basis? You sort of did for a long time, yes. I do these talks partly as a promise, fulfillment of a promise to a young woman I know extremely well. As initially her volunteer for the Minnesota AIDS Project, she was diagnosed with AIDS when her baby was 18 months old and couldn't get well. And they lived in a town of 300 people in southern Minnesota and went over and over to physicians, specialists in the cities, to find out what was wrong with her child. And they never tested Candace for HIV because of the assumption that a family in a small community in southern Minnesota would not ever be affected with this illness. When she first was assigned to me as a volunteer, I only knew Nancy's first name and we only talked by phone. She was terrified of being known in her small community. By the time she died 3 years ago, the Star Tribune had done two several page photojournalist articles on their whole family, and Brian, the photographer, has won some awards for his coverage of their family. They had also gone to Washington, D.C. for Pediatric AIDS Day marches. They've met with Senator Paul Wellstone. So in about 5 years, this family living with AIDS in our little community nearby to our community went from terrified of being found out to being extremely public. I'm just going to pass this around while I'm talking because it's a very powerful reminder of the impact of AIDS in people's lives. And I promised Nancy that after she died, I would continue to do as much talking about AIDS in people's lives as I could manage to do. So pleased to be here. I'm going to assume for most folks here that AIDS 101 is already known, but you're welcome to ask me anything about AIDS. I'm not a scientist or a microbiologist. I know it from a psychosocial point of view, but I know a fair amount about the virus, et cetera. And we're going to go over just a couple things as reminders. But let me read just a couple pieces out of some real stories here. This is the Simon family. Eric Simon sits in a chair at the foot of his mother's bed. He stares at her as she sleeps. He is pale, bare-chested, wrapped in a blanket. His eyes are vacant, his face expressionless. He slowly rocks himself back and forth, something she no longer can do for him. His mother, Nancy Simon, is 31 and has AIDS. He's only 10, and already he has seen her go through a lot. She's legally blind. She has endured lymphoma, pneumonia, blood transfusions, a hysterectomy, shingles, chronic diarrhea, and nausea. A month before, he helped her up from the floor when she fell off the toilet. She's unstable because of the neuropathy in her aching legs. It is February, deep in last winter's bone-chilling cold. In May, with its hesitant spring, Nancy will die. But for now, Eric waits. For now, he does not know how much remains of their time together. Eric and his brother Brian, who's 12, watch her waste away a little more each day. Yet they also observe her courage, faith, and relentless hope for a miracle from the illness that already has robbed them of their only sister and eventually will take their father, Doug, also. Doug got the virus in 1983 from a blood transfusion that he needed when he developed intestinal problems during basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia. He passed it to their mom and she to their younger sister, Candace, who was born with the virus. Candace died 3 years ago. Before all that happened, when Eric and Brian were younger, their mom used to get up early to prepare a big breakfast with pancakes, bacon, and eggs for the whole family. Now on this day, their mom is too sick to do most things for them. If Eric decides to eat breakfast today, it will be cold cereal he will dish up himself. He'll take the bowl to her bedside, eat his cereal, watch TV, and watch his mom. Sometimes at night, he sleeps with her. He loves crawling in beside her and snuggling up. Sometimes Eric stands on the sofa and stares at his family's portrait illuminated on the wall by a brass light. In the textured canvas that resembles an oil painting, Eric and his mom, dad, brother, and sister are all smiling. Everyone feels good. He looks at it almost in awe. In 1995, when Nancy Simon spoke to students at St. Olaf College in Northfield about her family's battle with AIDS, she was blunt about what lay ahead. "I'm going to die of AIDS. My daughter died of AIDS. My husband is going to die of AIDS. My two sons will be orphaned." I have the rest of their story here, and so I'm going to pass it, at least for the pictures. Do try to take a peek at it. And if anybody wants to read the full story, you're welcome to, because I'm here. I'm not leaving today, unlike half my family. Some of you heard me read portions of Phil Knutson's letter yesterday. Many of you know who Phil was. He worked at the National Office in Chicago with campus ministry for the Lutheran Church and came out as both gay and having AIDS a number of years ago. Died, I believe, in 1995 or 6, but he came out in his late 50s. And he came and spoke at St. Olaf about his story and has left a two-page letter for many folks to read. I'm going to leave it in the reference room here, too. Let me do some just basic stuff, and then we can get into some of the family issues. I don't like to use a lot of statistics, but I think it's significant to note that just about 700,000 people have been diagnosed in the United States alone with AIDS. That's full-blown AIDS. The number of people with HIV infection is unknown. Why is that?
Don't have symptoms quite often. You
right.
No one
was tested. Right. Like people like this little family in Vesely, Minnesota, had no idea they had HIV. So the number of people who are infected with the virus, we don't know. And only about a third of the states in our country track reported HIV infection. It's not required by law to keep track in every state of HIV. It is required to keep track of people diagnosed with AIDS. Let me just talk about what that means. When AIDS was first figured out, we used to see pyramid pictures. Remember these pyramids? That top of the pyramid, sort of, or above the ocean, if you will, is the people with AIDS, where below the surface, below the ocean surface, perhaps, are the larger number of people with HIV. That's still useful to help us remind ourselves how many more people have HIV infection than have AIDS. But now medical folks more commonly use this kind of horizontal image for HIV disease. It's more useful. We have several stages, four to be exact. The first stage is the time of infection. Many people don't know when exactly they became infected. Though usually soon after infection, people have a flu-like illness. Well, as I say in Minnesota to my classes of 35 people, how many of you have ever had a flu-like illness? Of course, every hand goes up. So most people don't think of it as perhaps a time of HIV infection. That goes away. People feel good, often for a long time. And in the second stage, it's asymptomatic asymptomatic HIV disease. That means no symptoms. How long can this go? Weeks to months to many, many, many years. 12 years, 15 years, we're now following some people who are asymptomatic HIV positive. And we're studying those folks. Why is it that some people remain asymptomatic for a long time? The third stage is symptomatic HIV disease. People begin to experience symptoms like chronic fatigue, severe weight loss, dry coughs, night sweats, other kinds of things that are very difficult, but not AIDS. So that's symptomatic HIV. That can also last quite a long time, even up to a number of years for people. Then there's stage four, which is AIDS, full-blown AIDS, which is acquired immune deficiency syndrome. So AIDS is not a disease. I haven't seen the last count of AIDS diseases that people can have, but it's over 30. It may be close to 40 different diseases people can have to give them the diagnosis of AIDS as a syndrome. I used to draw a line about here then and say death. I don't do that anymore. This time of symptomatic HIV, asymptomatic HIV, and AIDS has extended out for a lot of people a long ways, which is why I say at the end here, question mark of death. We have people living with AIDS much more in a chronic situation than when I began AIDS work. It was always terminal immediately. People came into the hospital, they died. So most of my work at the time was bereavement with partners, lovers, family members, friends. That's not necessarily the case anymore. There's certainly still loss and grieving, but not as often as quickly death. So we don't know how long that's going to go, and that waits to be seen. Transmission of the virus has not changed since we first figured out how it was transmitted. There are three major ways. One is sexual contact with infected blood. That means infected blood gets into our system somehow through sexual intercourse or exchange of infectious body fluids, notably blood. IV drug use is the other most common way, where people share needles and works and don't clean their needles and syringes between sharing the drug. So the blood from HIV-infected person remains in the needle or syringe and is injected into the other person. The third, increasingly more common way of transmitting HIV is vertical transmission, which is perinatal, from mother to child. We know now that that happens in utero, or at birth, or through breastfeeding, through breast milk. Most commonly, it happens in utero or at birth. However, a very hopeful sign, and I always say we have to say something hopeful when we talk about AIDS, is that the incidence of perinatal transmission is decreasing in our country because of improved counseling and testing of pregnant women. There are efforts all over the country, public health departments, to educate physicians and clinics to say, when you have a pregnant mom, take her history. If there's any possible indication that she might have had behavior that would put her at risk for HIV, test her. And if she's positive, 10 years ago, we couldn't offer her anything except abortion. Or we say, you have your baby, you have somewhere between a 10 and a 35% chance of passing on HIV without any intervention. Now we have intervention. We give a drug called zidovudine during pregnancy, and it has decreased the number and percentage of babies born to infected mothers quite dramatically in this country. This is a country that's wealthy enough to give zidovudine to HIV-infected mothers. All over the world, that's not necessarily the case. But those are the ways that transmission occurs, and those have not changed since the beginning of the epidemic. Let me stop here before I get into the family issues stuff and see if folks have questions or clarifications for that kind of data. Let me give you another couple of statistics. When I started AIDS work, it was rare to see HIV in women in our country at all. Women now are 1/5 of the folks with diagnosed AIDS in our country. It is dramatically increasing in women. Most women with HIV are IV drug users or the sexual partners of HIV drug users. IV drug users who have HIV. It's also increasing in our young people. We're seeing some disturbing trends with adolescents who say that's an old issue. People are living with AIDS now, there are drugs, and you know, I have to worry about that as much as I worry about herpes. It's not going to kill me. If I get it, I get it. I'll take meds and I'll live for a while. Adds to sort of the general adolescent sense of, well, it's not my problem, it's not going to happen to me, and I'm not going to worry about it. We also see young gay male adolescents say that's an issue for the old guys. They lived through it, they dealt with it, we don't have to. It's not as big a concern anymore. It's very, very sad. 75% of the women and children with AIDS in our country are black or Hispanic. Let me repeat that. 75% of the women and kids in our country are African American or Hispanic. Now I say to my students, why is that? Is that because their skin color is darker than Caucasians? Well, most of them know enough to say it. Well, I don't think it's just about their skin color as a physical characteristic. It is about their skin color as making most of them victims of discrimination in things like health insurance, being in poor areas with little access to health care, giving up many of them a sense of hopelessness about the future. So many more in African American and Hispanic communities turn to IV drug use, which is a wonderful way to spread HIV infection with your drug using partners and then your sexual partners. So it has to do with the plethora of psychosocial stuff around people of color in our country being discriminated against, and we see dramatically higher percentages of HIV infection in those populations, which is quite sad. Okay, let's talk a little about the effect HIV/AIDS has on families.
Could I ask you one more
please.
Thing? Do you have any idea? Do you have any idea how successful or unsuccessful the safe sex education programs have been? It's hard to get a handle on.
It's hard to get a handle on because the programs have been so localized.
Yeah.
And every study that studies them is different from other studies, so it's hard to generalize nationally. Let me make a couple of comments, though, that I am very aware of. One is that it seems that efforts to talk about safe sex with young people are very successful in getting young people to answer on quizzes the right answers. Their knowledge has increased dramatically. We know every kid who's 15 could tell you how you get HIV pretty well. There are some who have the school nurse tells me some really scary stories in Northfield, but generally they know. Attitudes have also changed a fair amount. Most people say on studies, well, we know we need to take care of people with HIV, and we know generally we can't get it by caring for people at home, giving them food, and we generally can't get it from healthcare workers who are infected, so forth. It's behavior that's the problem. So knowledge and attitude have changed. Behavior in many folks have not. When people are honest about their sexual and drug use history, and notice I say when, because a lot of people are not honest about their sexual histories, they do say things like, well, yeah, I've had sex with 10 different people in the last year, and probably I used condoms a quarter of the time. So they know they should use condoms. That's the knowledge. Do they use them? That's the behavior. The other issue that has come up is that we, for a while, were talking about safe sex. What is safe sex? No exchange of body fluids. No exchange of body fluids is safe sex. And that is safe sex. Mutual massage, masturbation without exchange of fluids, that's safe, and that's sex, okay? But safer sex is what we really ought to be talking about. And if you see the brochures and pamphlets that are quite graphic about what's safe and what's unsafe, the variation of sexual behavior is quite something. And I don't think we've been nearly as clear with people about, is it really safe sex we're talking about or safer sex? I mean, condoms with sex is safer, it isn't safe. Condoms fail, people fail. I tell the students, think about putting on a condom in the dark when you're half drunk, which is what happens for adolescents, especially in colleges. That's where the unsafe sex happens. They're half drunk. And they're in bed with somebody they don't know. And they don't know what they're doing putting on a condom. It's very different than sitting in a classroom and practicing on a condom model or a banana or something. So that's where we've really erred, I'm afraid. The other thing we erred on very early on which has sort of two sides to a coin, is that the gay community took incredible leadership in having our country and the world understand AIDS and HIV. And the gay community led the federal government, they led the churches, they led public health and public education in efforts to tell people how to stay safe. And it worked pretty well in the gay community for quite a while. Trouble is, it was the gay, white, upper-class male community. And there were many communities that were not early on educated. There were people who don't speak English or have English as a second language. There were IV drug users. There were women. There were gay men in communities of color that didn't have access. There were bisexual men who were married and living in the suburbs of the Twin Cities. These folks got no info through much of the early 80s, so that we had a second and a third and a fourth epidemic coming to our country. The first was primarily in the gay male community. So that was wonderful on the part of the gay community for doing as much as they did, and the rest of us kind of didn't catch up, and we're paying for it now, I'm afraid. So, good question. Okay, well, I tend to think as a social worker that families always should be the focus of attention. I don't believe individuals focus autonomously. Work, behave, think autonomously. We are embedded in a fabric of family, and I've talked some this week about different kinds of family. When we talk about AIDS in the family, we have to talk about all kinds of families. Gay male couples, couples where one is bisexual. We have to talk about parents of kids with HIV AIDS. We have to talk about children whose parents have AIDS. We have to talk about the adult siblings of adults who are diagnosed with AIDS. We have to talk about siblings of small children, like Eric and Brian, whose sister had AIDS. We talk about extended family, which is enormous. So I used to draw on the board for my students, if you have right here the person who is HIV infected, HIV positive, think about that person being average age, somewhere probably in the early 30s, late 20s to early 30s is the average age of infection in our country. Think about that person still having a couple living parents, probably a couple sets of grandparents still alive if that person's in the early 30s, may well have a partner or two or three, spouse or other partners, lots of friends, may even have a child or two, or three, think of all the people affected by that one person's diagnosis with HIV infection. It's really dramatic, and most of you have had experience. You know somebody. It's very rare now that I go and speak anywhere and I ask in the audience, how many know someone with HIV, that at least half of people don't raise their hands. That's rare. When I first started, I'd have one timid person say, well, I do, but sort of I don't want anyone to know that I know someone. Part of my hope for the whole week that I've been teaching is that people put out on the table these secrets, these difficult issues to talk about so they can get some assistance with it. Now, one of the issues for AIDS that we have to put out is unlike most other diseases, except for some that are genetically passed on in families, if there is a family with an AIDS, a person with AIDS in the family, generally there's more than one. And if we define family as a gay family, generally those folks know a lot of people with AIDS or have lost a lot of friends and former lovers to AIDS. In a family like the Simons, the dad got HIV, passed it to the mother unknowingly sometime in their married life. Two children were born without it. We still don't know the mechanics of why they didn't get it and then Candace did, but when Nancy got it from Doug, and then how come Candace got it and the other kids didn't. So out of five in a nuclear family, three have it. Doug is still living. Nancy and Candace have died. So that we're not talking about the family that has a person with Alzheimer's, like in my family, or a person with cancer. Usually if we have cancer in the family, we don't have several people with the same cancer at the same time. Now, it certainly has happened that several have cancer. But I think that's an important impact so that the loss and the issues are multiplied throughout the family system. Oftentimes, family members haven't received enough information and begin to experience some major panic and fear. And this often results in secret keeping or, as we talked about yesterday, when a family member comes out as gay or lesbian, others in the family often go into the closet, sort of, I can't tell anybody this. So somebody's found to have AIDS and the rest of the family says, oh, where can I talk about this? Often secrets happen. HIV disease is a roller coaster. One day people will be in the hospital near death, then they'll be home working again in a week or two. It's amazing, and there is no generalizing about this disease. It affects everybody differently, and the constellation of symptoms and diseases is unique to the individual. So there's no way to know in the future how it's going to go, how many times a person will be really sick, or if there will be one episode that ends that person's life at some point. So that is very difficult with the up and down roller coaster nature of it. People start on certain drugs, they work for a while, then they get another disease, start on those drugs, maybe at the same time they're on some drugs that try to prevent other kinds of diseases. These are called drug cocktails, and what I meant to bring and didn't, it's very effective. Is a little canister of the meds that the average person who has insurance and is willing to be on meds takes in this country who has AIDS. Now dump it out, it's like 30 or 40, 50 pills a day, and they have to take certain of them with food and certain of them every 4 hours around the clock. And so people who are on these drug cocktails have little stopwatches that go off regularly, like many people on other kinds of drugs. But The good news is that some of these drugs seem to be working incredibly well. Some people with AIDS have been found to have virtually no virus anymore. It's not cured. It's generally somewhere. So that's very hopeful. Drugs, however, are extremely expensive. Not everybody has insurance. And we're only looking at the United States and industrialized countries. Around the world, people do not have access to these fancy drug combinations. We're also seeing some people who've been on the drug cocktails up to 2 years now starting to fail and get sick again, which is what happened with AZT. It worked really great to put off the progression of disease for a while, and after about 2 years, people started having other problems. So it's not an answer yet, but we're getting there. One of the difficulties is because people on these drugs have to be so cognizant of when they take them and with what kind of food, etc. It really needs people who are bright, can read, or people with them who are bright and can read, and keep them on the drugs. Otherwise, people miss doses, miss a day or two, and then what happens? Drug resistance. Some HIV virus is a very smart, tricky little virus. It changes, mutates, but the covering on the virus changes periodically. And if we're not, just like with TB, which by the way is on the increase dramatically because of HIV, people don't take the drugs when they're supposed to, for as long as they're supposed to. And I often say to audiences, "When, how many of you have taken antibiotics until you feel better and then quit taking them?" This is why we have a problem with antibiotics in this country, as I understand it. Same is true for the HIV virus. So it really takes a family around the infected person to aid in that drug regimen, to ensure that drugs are taken when they need to be. I want to always say issues for rural families are different than for urban families, although there are generalizations probably we can make for both, but in rural areas, access to services, to support, to people living with the same thing is much more difficult because of distance, transportation, etc. Okay, let me talk. You know, I could talk about each one of these groupings in the families, and I think what I might do is just ask first whether out of these groups, gay couples, heterosexual couples where one is bisexual, parents with kids with parents, sibs, extended family, why don't you pick two or three that we could talk about first, because we're not going to have enough time for me to go through every possible family combination here. Somebody have a particular interest you'd want to hear about? Or you want me to just pick a few? Yeah.
Well, I think it would be hard to understand how a bisexual, a married couple where one is distinctly bisexual, how that what are some of the ways, yeah, how do they deal with that? What are the support needs?
Our state epidemiologist in Minnesota is one of the leaders in AIDS in public health, Mike Osterholm, and I heard him speak once about a study he'd done on bisexual couples in suburban Twin Cities. And how many of these men had fairly casual sexual encounters with men in the city and then came home and lived their life as a straight man with a wife? How many of them travel on business trips and had lovers in other cities, gay lovers in other cities? Homosexual lovers, I should say. Not necessarily gay, because bisexual men don't generally think of themselves as gay. I think probably the issues of secrecy in that situation are the most difficult, if I can generalize. Because families, at least where I am from, now in the 90s, get more attention when kids are involved. And this has to do with the layers of stigma about innocent versus not so innocent and some things that I find difficult to handle, actually. But I think so many of these folks are living a double life and have to decide when and if to come out about that. I read a whole book on bisexuality in Africa that was really fascinating, and I talked to people in Mexico, and in Mexican culture, men who have sex with men, which is really the better way to talk about this when we're talking about HIV, because even people who are married and consider themselves straight wouldn't call themselves, some of them, bisexual, but they say, well, yeah, I've had some sex with men. So the public health folks say men who have sex with men. They don't use bi or gay or any other title. They just talk about the risky behavior. And in Mexico, gay men are men who are the ones who are the recipients, the passive recipients of anal sex. And people, the men who are the active inserters in anal sex are the people who are seen as macho. So they're not looked at as gay. So, you know, even how we talk about what's bisexual is very complicated. And I don't think the average person in the pew or in the school or in the community knows what we mean when we say that word. So I think that's why the layer is really incredibly difficult. The partner, notably the women, because it's rare to see woman-to-woman transmission of HIV. It can happen theoretically, and there have been a few cases in the country. But because vaginal fluids are infectious, but nowhere near as infectious as blood and semen, it's hard for a woman to give it to a woman. So usually we're talking about a straight woman with a husband who's had sex with men and then had sex with her. And I think the issues for her of anger and, you know, what kind of woman am I and why didn't I see it coming and things are just, they're incredibly complicated. And then for the male, guilt and fear and suicidal tendencies, and it's really complex. So a very interesting report in the Star Trib just before I came up here, some of you have seen it. We now have so many straight, heterosexual couples living for a long time when one of them has HIV that they're asking doctors around the country to help them father or birth children. And this issue was an ethical question about this male wanted his sperm washed. The HIV is not in the sperm itself, it's in the semen that the sperm is in. So they had the sperm washed of all the infectious fluid and then implanted, you know, in tubes with the woman's egg and then implanted in the woman, and they're hoping then the child will not have HIV. So things are getting more and more complicated. If somebody's HIV infected at 22 and lives till they're 45 or 50, they want to have children. So raise the question, should they, and what should doctors do? And so one of the doctors in the city says, ask the AMA to convene a group of bioethicists and theologians to say, well, what are we doing about this one? That's the latest. I hadn't really heard or read about that. What else of the families do you want to talk about? I did some special research with women in HIV. Maybe let me just talk about that. As I mentioned, most women in the United States who have HIV are IV drug users themselves or partners of IV drug users. Most. It's sort of the vast majority of women. And because of that, they are generally not connected with a lot of family, because IV drug using folks generally are not in healthy, solid, financially capable families. So many of those women are poor. Many live in substandard housing, have no health insurance. Most of them are caring for spouses who are also HIV infected, because women tend to be the caregivers. And even if it's the partner or spouse who gave it to them, it's the woman who cares for the man in general. They may also be caring for children with HIV or certainly without HIV. What I found is the women who are HIV infected tended to be the last ones to get health care. And that's true for women who aren't HIV infected. Most women caregivers say, well, the kids' needs are first, my husband's needs are first, my aging parents are first, and then I'll go. And it was certainly true for these women. They did not get in to get health care until they were very sick. And if you wait to get any treatment for HIV disease until you have AIDS, and further on, and for many women that was pretty far on, there's not a whole lot to do. So I found that was a fairly interesting and sort of sad phenomenon. Support groups for women took a long time to get going. Again, because the gay male community was so out in front with dealing with the issue and figuring out services, that it was hard for the early women. Nancy had to talk to other women with HIV in Minnesota by phone, long distance, to get anybody who was in her similar kind of situation. It was very hard for her for a long time. A lot of women, because they generally make less money than men, if they've been in the workforce, have been paid less, have fewer benefits, have come in and out, perhaps, of the workforce to have children or to do caregiving. And so often when they are sick and become disabled, have fewer benefits available to them financially. And I always talk about women as caregivers in families, whether the women have HIV or not. Because HIV infection has affected all kinds of families in the U.S. where the infection isn't in the family. Nurses' aides, think about healthcare. It's about 80% women who provide direct service healthcare to people with HIV. And I had several nurses in those early years who came to me in tears and said, Mary, I can't tell my husband that I'm taking care of people with AIDS on my unit. My dad has threatened to cut off my loans for nursing school if I take care of anyone with AIDS. So the effect, notably on women, though certainly on some men too, just goes on and on, because women do most of the caregiving. And the toll there is very, very difficult. I think when kids have HIV, there are some special issues. When to tell the child, what to tell the child. Children talk. Sometimes children are accurate, sometimes they aren't. What's the risk of your business being told all over the community, which I've certainly found is true in Northfield. Parents of my daughter's friends say, well, we understand you're going to blah, blah, blah. I haven't really talked about it or planned it yet, but Rachel overheard. For Nancy, the issue became very real when Candace got to be three and wanted to be in preschool with all her friends in this little community at the Catholic preschool. And that was the time the family came out as an AIDS family in this town of 300. Catholic church in the middle of the town was it. The whole town was Polish Catholic. And they talked to the priest with the help of a Catholic nun from the cities who had done the Archdiocesan AIDS ministry, had just started it. She was fabulous. So she came down, met with the priest, and they met with the whole community so that the daycare teachers would know. But you can't, in a community of 300, tell the daycare teacher and not think everyone is me. So that was an issue. Then who at the school deserves to know? That was a large issue in the late 80s. And we have resolved that to say nobody needs to know at the schools. Not the school nurse, not the custodian, not the teachers. Why is that? Everybody in those situations is to use universal precautions. Any kid who bleeds, that blood should be cleaned up by people who are taking precautions with blood or at least a barrier of some sort. Because HIV is not the only thing in people's bloods we need to worry about. Isn't that interesting? Most people say, oh, shouldn't the school nurse know? Well, if for your child, you'd like the school nurse to know, that's something different. Partly for your child's protection, if the nurse sees something to be concerned about, perhaps. But no one needs to know in the school. And need to know is the legal phrase. It's told on a need-to-know basis. Very interesting, since universal precautions. We have kids living a long time now with AIDS. Long time. They used to die younger, faster. They used to get sick faster. But we're finding some amazing children with amazing immune system function. We don't know why yet. We're studying that. They live 10 years, 12 years. We have some kids now who were diagnosed when they were infants, and they're close to 15 years old. Not very many, but some. So that'd be something to watch. I think... Let me talk a little about what I think families need when others of us hear about someone with HIV in the family, and then I'd like to open it up. Because like yesterday, I said a lot of people sort of nodding, like, I know this is awful, and I know something, I could say something here, so I want people to be able to say. HIV is still a life-threatening diagnosis. My worry is that, I see this at St. Olaf all the time, AIDS, it's not hot anymore. So we got it. It's like herpes, it's like diabetes, it's like other things we can manage. It's true. It's much more chronic than terminal nowadays. It's still life-threatening. Somebody could get sick very fast and die still having HIV compromise their immune system. So families need to have the support that you'd give any family who has a life-threatening illness diagnosed in the family system. Families, no matter how smart and educated and open, are still afraid of contagion. They're afraid they'll get it. And I love to tell this little story. I'd been doing AIDS work in the hospital for 2 years. I've been to every training about HIV. I knew that I was not at risk from sitting in a room holding a person's hand who was dying of AIDS. And one gentleman who's about my age was dying, and I was in his hospital room, and with a very weak hand, he leaned over to his hospital table, picked up a piece of candy from a bowl, and said, please have this candy. I said, thank you, that's great. And I put it in my pocket. And I went out in the hall, and I just had this total panic. I can't eat that candy. He just touched it. And I sought out one of the physicians who I saw in the hallway, said, talk to me, because I know I can't get it, but I'm terrified. And he gave it to me. It was a wrapped piece of candy that he held in his hand. I couldn't get HIV from that piece of candy. That was interesting to note. I, who knew a lot, had seen a lot, had been thrown up on, you know, had blood on my hands, though I was a social worker, not a nurse, so I wasn't at the great risk that nurses can be at if they don't take precautions. I needed to be talked down, so families certainly do. What about drinking glasses and toothbrushes and razors and, you know, really? Can I believe what I'm told? So people need to have help in talking about their fear of contagion, which is very real for families. As I mentioned yesterday, I think a very important first step for families is no matter what one believes about the cause and of the HIV, how one got it, one must accept the HIV status. As I often say, it doesn't matter so much where it came from, but where it's going. Is it really useful for me to go on and on about my brother who got HIV from IV drug use? Or is it important to go on about how I'm going to work with my brother for our relationship and help him live as well as possible for as long as possible? So to accept the fact of HIV, like I suggest we accept the fact of homosexuality, whatever we believe about it, and whatever difficulties we have, if we don't say, well, it's there. This person says he's gay. This person has HIV infection. That's how we move forward. Most therapists I know think that this is a really crucial place with HIV for families. To just say, we know we have it in the family and we need to move along. Families have to be able to cope with stigma and discrimination. So advocates outside those families who care about them in the church, in the schools, in the healthcare setting, need to work with families a lot. Many families feel and truly have a time limit in the family. We don't know how long some people will live. But like any life-threatening illness, it could be a shorter time than people think they have. So if there's a need for reconciliation in the family, the drug-using daughter who comes home, the gay uncle who's been separate for a long time comes to be cared for. If that reconciliation needs to happen, there is a time crunch, and that involves sort of moving ahead emotionally faster than some people are ready for. Family roles tend to shift, especially when there are parents who have HIV and there's some children who don't. We talked earlier in the week about the kids becoming caregivers. When we talked about Eric helping his mother up when she fell, those are role shifts that family ending. And with this family, we had one point where several of us said, the kids are doing too much. They were 10 and 12, and they were cooking for mom, cleaning the house, helping her walk to the bathroom, helping dress her. We said, 10 and 12-year-old boys shouldn't have to do that. And we pushed Nancy to accept some outside help, home health aides and nurses' aides at home, which she did accept at some point. I think families need a terrific amount of assistance with negotiating external systems, finding the support groups, finding a doctor who will take care of them and know what he's doing or she's doing, know what's available in the community for outside financial or meals or transportation or eventually long-term care or hospice assistance, so we can do that. I think I will stop there. There is so much with this, it's hard to know where to cover. But what comments do people make, questions you have about AIDS? I just hope that we can keep it in the forefront of our thinking and not just say, that was an issue with AIDS. It's gone. It's not gone. HIV infection is spreading rapidly because young people think it's gone. It's scary. Anything about how it's transmitted, how to help people?
There's been some talk about adolescents and that adolescents are at risk now. Are there a special state? I suppose it's most, you were mentioning already within the African American and Hispanic population.
Well,
because of the IV drug use.
Yeah, but look at this. In Minnesota, studies show if kids are telling the truth.
Yeah.
If kids are telling the truth. 75% of kids who graduate from high school have had intercourse.
And I guess I'm wondering...
Is not protected.
Right. And I work with adolescents.
Yes.
I work with teen mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering how much virus is there floating around. Because I know what my...
A lot more than we would like to know.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
And, you know, kids talk about... Well, I didn't really have sex technically. Well, you say, well, what was it? Well, you know, he came, but it wasn't really in me. It was sort of on me. You kind of say, well, look, kids. Where the virus is in all these fluids. So anything that's messy is dangerous. That's how I talk to the kids, right? Anything that's messy is dangerous. But I think our biggest barrier is the barrier we've had since time began. They don't wear helmets. They drink and drive. They're adolescents, and they say, this is not me. I don't know when we recognize mortality. Some of us younger if we lose family members. Mm-hmm. But even then, so what I have seen works, and back to your question about studies, some studies say that what works is teens talking to teens, period. You know, an 18-year-old who says, look, I messed up, and look at me now. I've lost this and this and this. I can't play football. I can't because of this. That hits home at least for a while, and if we can hit home for long enough for kids to get through the risky time and mature, I think there is hope. I even struggle with whether I should teach the course anymore to 21-year-olds. They all think they need to know because they're going to be helping these people. They don't look at their sexual behavior when they're, as I said, drinking. That's the biggest worry for me is young people who drink and then engage in all sorts of risky sexual behavior. Very scary for me. And I love, there was some study in Northfield, or some piece of the Minnesota State study, and they can identify areas of the state. And I have friends with adolescent kids who said, isn't that awful? And I know it's not my kids. I know it isn't my kids. I just think, how do you know it's not your kids? We don't know it's not our kids. And so we have denial. It's, you know, other people do things like that. And it's not our own children.
There's that show not too long ago that's saying that there was an increase in elderly.
Yeah.
Because they believe
they don't
get pregnant anymore, so they're just having sex. And then when the elderly woman said, well, it takes 10 years to really come full bloom, so I'm not going to live that on anyway. What do I care?
No.
But it's the fact that we're spreading it. It's not, you know, in everybody's mind, like you say, it's just a back, you know,
who cares? Yeah, and that brings up two important things, well, three. Over 50, and I don't say that's elderly because I'm close enough, but transmission over 50 is increasing dramatically. I neglect it, so I'm really glad. Partly because they don't think they're at risk, and because doctors don't think to ask people over 50 about their sexual and drug use history, and so they don't test, and then they get sicker, and they're further along. Secondly, for many people in the drug-using community, and in poor communities in general, without hope for the future, here's a mother who says, look, I don't have any money, I can't feed my kids today, why should I worry about something that might kill me in 10 to 20 years? Same thing. I'm going to die of a gunshot wound, of hunger, of something, murder, something else. Maybe they're not that clear about it, but the sense of hopelessness says, why should I worry about something that's, you know, way down the road? So they're exchanging sex for drugs, sex for money to get drugs. That's a big issue. The other thing that if a physician at an unnamed university in Ohio told me, he's a doctor there in the health service, he said, I have girls coming in here all the time, and I ask them about their sexual history and behavior, and they say to me, I'm a virgin. And he says, well, talk to me about that. Well, I never have vaginal sex, never have vaginal intercourse. Okay, tell me what you do. Well, we have anal intercourse, because then I won't get pregnant, and I'm a virgin. Now, that's an adolescent issue. Mm-hmm. You know, male penetration in the rectum of girls, so they won't get pregnant, and they don't. And they call themselves virgins. This guy had seen a lot in his life, and that stopped him in his tracks. And he said, isn't that one? There's one I'd be distressed for the one. It is a lot of girls talking about that. That's really something. It's really something.
I had an adolescent say to me one time when we were teaching a sex class at church, and they said, well, I don't have to worry because they say that if you're in a long-term relationship, it isn't a problem. And I said, well, what do you call a long-term relationship? She said, I've been going with them for 2.5 weeks.
Yeah, oh boy. Yeah. Well, you certainly can see my bias. My bias is you use language, you're direct, you're clear, you're straightforward. We, I think, do our young people a disservice by sort of talking around these issues. And if we got kids thinking 2.5 weeks is long term, we got troubles. And if we're saying things like long term relationships, you know, where you're mutually committed and you don't have any sexual behavior outside that is great, we have to define what we mean by that. And then we have to say, do you believe it when your partner says, no, I've never had sexual intercourse, or better yet, I've never exchanged body fluids with anyone else? That's where people lie all the time. Adults at 50 lie about that. And when we first started HIV, we were saying, well, back 10 years, you gotta be right. Back almost 20 now, folks. 20 years back. You have to believe a sex partner if he says or she says, I haven't done any drugs. I didn't have any surgery prior to 1983 that involved a blood transfusion. That still is an issue prior to 1983 when we started testing blood. And I've never exchanged body fluids with somebody. So people say, well, what do we do then? How do we know if it's okay to marry somebody and have sex? Well, I say the best thing you can do is go to a testing clinic together, get tested together, get the results together, don't do anything to exchange body fluids for 6 months, go back to the same clinic, get tested again together, and hear the results together. And then you're probably 99.9% sure that you're both free of HIV. Long term. You're talking a year, Mary. I say, that's right. That's right. I'm talking a year. And that would be for 50-year-olds too. It's the same thing. The same thing.
If a caregiver is accidentally exposed to body fluids and they don't know the status of the person they're caring for, do they have the right to ask that they be tested?
That the person who may have infected them be tested?
Yes.
We have the right to ask anything. Do we have the right to force it? No. No. Does it happen without people's consent? Sure. So that's a complicated thing, but what we do now, in any formal setting where healthcare is provided, home healthcare, hospice, hospital, the caregiver is exposed to body fluids accidentally, notably blood. They don't usually do this for other body fluids, but is they can start a prophylactic AZT, azadavidine sort of mix of stuff for a certain period of time. They do that for needle sticks for healthcare workers. You can always ask, but you can't force anybody to have an HIV test in Minnesota. Now, that may be different in some other states. There are real variations about testing in various states. First responders, you know, paramedics and ambulance drivers, EMTs, brought this up and said, you know, I'm at the scene of an accident and it is bloody. And, you know, so I use universal precautions, and I did that with an accident victim, and this state trooper and I were doing the CPR, and every time I pushed, blood came out. That guy had a bag, ambu-bag and everything. We were covered. We tried, but we were covered. Did we have the legal right to force an HIV test on that victim? No. No. That's amazing. We really do respect individual people's rights to that kind of thing.
Most of the time, the person is very cooperative.
Yes. It'd be very rare. Yeah. I mean, right. Thank you for saying that. Because
they feel bad.
They feel terrified.
They feel bad. You get the healthcare worker stuck on a needle, and that patient will come back, they'll get tested again, they're concerned, and they'll go to work most of the time.
Exactly. Notably, the people who already are HIV infected. So the worry is if they don't know, and we don't know, and they're not sure they want to know because of all the other stuff that might bring up, that can be an issue, but that's so very true. I saw more patients yell at nurses, put on your gloves. And these nurses say, oh, but you know, it's so much work, it's a hazard. I'm not letting you touch me till you put on your gloves. It happened often that the patient was doing the protecting, the patient who knew he or she was infected. What else? Anything? Ew, got a minute. Yeah.
I think with the people that I'm around, the thing that they have such questions about, and it's one of the reasons I came to all these classes, because you want to be informed, is the fear and not knowing what to do about homosexuality. They don't know whether to accept it or to condemn it, or now the ELCA voting on this issue, and that's coming up again at their convention. You know, people don't know how to handle it, and you have all these workshops in your church, and trying to decide which side you're going to be on. If you're going as a delegate, you have to vote, and that's what I deal with more than any other. And I, of course, also have had people die of AIDS that I know real well. And so that sort of thing. But there's all of this.
Very
it's so complicated that
yep.
you can almost...
And HIV, I think, put us 20 years behind in the tolerance and acceptance of homosexuality. Put us 20 years behind because the blame of the gay community across the world has, as the cause of AIDS, has really put us back. And then the fear of people who are gay getting AIDS, it's really, it's all wrapped up. I say to people, and I say this usually at the beginning of my talks, the only better person, I think, to talk about AIDS is somebody who has it. I think the best way to learn is to talk to people. Listen to people who have AIDS. Listen to gay and lesbian people talk. Listen to their stories. That's what I tell these people who are, I don't know what to do. I say, get to know someone. Bishop Chilstrom said the first time he went to a meeting of Lutherans Concerned, in a room of 100 gay and lesbian Lutherans, and there he was. He was still a lower bishop when he did that. They'd written him for years, please come to a meeting, please come to a meeting. He wouldn't do it. Finally, he did it. He said it transformed him to listen to the pain, to listen to the desire to be part of the church, to listen to believe in God. So I think the only way people can learn is the human touch. I'm going to end us just for the tape. I have a listing state by state of the sort of primary AIDS information center for every state. So if you want to know where in your state to get info, I have that right here, and you can just ask me. Try not to talk about Minnesota solely, even though it's probably half the village sometimes, but not always. So I appreciate your coming on a lovely day, and I'd be willing to stay if somebody has questions too. Thanks.
Story came up to make it a week for a 15-year period.